Good afternoon. From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crummery. The city is now asking residents to weigh in on potential projects that could be funded by the fees paid by cruise ship passengers this year. Funding an extension of the Seawalk, adding more downtown public restrooms, and offsetting Juneau Mountain Rescue rescue costs are some of the projects. Residents have until May 3rd to submit comments. Each cruise ship passenger who comes to Juneau pays $13 worth of fees, referred to as marine passenger fees. This money can go toward funding projects that serve visitors and ease tourism impacts on locals. Every year, the city asks Juneau residents to submit proposals on what projects they want to see funded. Ideas also come from businesses and organizations the city partners with, and city staff. Alex Pierce, the city's visitor industry director, says some of the projects city staff recommend to the Juneau Assembly come directly from public feedback. She spoke to the Assembly about the proposals at a meeting last week and highlighted a recurring one.
Every year since I have been in this role, we have had a request for more restrooms downtown. It's definitely an identified need.
Juneau is estimated to see almost 1.7 million cruise ship visitors this coming tourism season. City leaders anticipate the fees will generate $24 million in revenue. But the money can't be used for just anything. A lawsuit the cruise industry filed and settled with the city in 2019 clarifies the limits on how and where the city can use the funds. From that settlement, the two parties agreed to meet annually to discuss the proposals with the aim of settling future disagreements outside of court. Most of the projects funded are downtown, but other areas of Juneau are eligible too, like the Mendenhall Valley near the glacier, as long as the project is related to tourism. Pierce reiterated that while cruise lines can object to some of the proposals, the final say about whether to move forward on a project ultimately lies in the hands of the Assembly. The public comment period on the proposed projects closes May 3rd. The Assembly will then review the proposals and public comments and decide which projects to fund. People can submit comments to Pierce at alexandrapierce@juneau.gov or by visiting the Marine Passenger Fee Program website. The Juneau Assembly will vote tonight during a regular meeting on whether to turn the city's cold weather emergency shelter into a year-round operation. Right now, it's only open from mid-October through mid-April. City officials say it will help address Juneau's current lack of shelter space and housing units, and it would reduce the number of unhoused people camping in the summer. If approved, it's expected to cost the city $1.1 million annually to operate, paid for using general funds. The shelter is located inside a city-owned warehouse in Thane, about a mile from downtown. It's funded by the city and operated by St. Vincent de Paul staff. It's considered Juneau's lowest barrier shelter and is meant to be a last resort for people without housing to survive the winter. But when the shelter typically closes its doors in mid-April, many of its patrons are left with few options for where to go to sleep, especially since the city closed the Mill Campground 3 years ago, which allowed unhoused people to set up camp through the summer. That resulted in Juneau seeing a surge of unhoused encampments throughout the borough, particularly near the Glory Hall shelter in the Mendenhall Valley. City officials say the year-round shelter operation would give an alternative to camping and theoretically reduce the number of encampments around town. That ordinance is open for public testimony tonight. So is another ordinance that would make the current City Hall building in downtown Juneau available for purchase. However, the Assembly doesn't plan to vote on the City Hall ordinance. They'll hear public testimony and then refer the ordinance back to committee to further discuss how they want to sell the building and any potential conditions they want to add to the sale. After that, it will come back again for public comment in the coming months before a final vote. Juneau residents have the chance to testify on ordinances on tonight's agenda, as well as on non-agenda items, in person or online before the Assembly votes. People who want to testify online must notify the city clerk by 4 p.m. before the meeting. The meeting begins at 6 p.m. at City Hall. You can hear it live on KTOO. And a labor union representing Ketchikan shipyard workers has filed 3 charges against the yard's new operator. The union claims that JAG Ketchikan has refused to negotiate with them on employee benefits from a 2023 collective bargaining agreement. As KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports, the new shipyard operator says it's not legally obligated to abide by that agreement.
The shipyard's labor union filed the charges in December, January, and March. Randy Golding is the union's Alaska business manager.
The biggest concern is the deterioration of the pre-existing conditions and benefits that we had negotiated for with the previous operator. With this new operator coming in, all that's off the table.
The union filed the charges with the National Labor Relations Board, asserting that JAG Marine Group is not recognizing them or their collective bargaining agreement that was adopted under the previous shipyard operator, Vigor. They allege JAG has made unilateral changes in terms and conditions of employment, including ending dirty pay, or special pay for work on ship septic systems containing human waste. William Earnhardt is an Anchorage-based attorney representing JAG. He says the company has no legal obligation to recognize the labor union or the collective bargaining agreement.
JAG is not a successor business. We didn't go in and just buy them out. So we're not a successor. We're hiring more employees. We're not bound by that contract.
JAG Marine Group took charge of the Ketchikan shipyard in September. That's after Alaska State Development Agency, ADA, ended a two-decade partnership with the shipyard's previous operator, Vigor. A 2025 letter from ADA cited Vigor's poor performance. Luke Rebecki is a Washington, D.C.-based attorney for the labor union. He says the Alaska chapter has represented Ketchikan's shipyard workers since 2022, when the facility operated under Vigor. Rebecki says the union negotiated a three-year labor contract that guaranteed wage increases and premium-free health insurance benefits, among other things. He says in January, under JAG, health insurance premiums went up by more than 25%. Here's Golding again, the union's Alaska business manager.
We want to make sure that the members are taken care of, and ultimately, we don't believe that JAG feels the same about the local membership as we do.
Bergen Wheeler is the general manager for JAG Ketchikan. He says the shipyard could have been shuttered if JAG hadn't taken it over. And he says the shipyard does currently offer voluntary, premium-based health insurance plans.
I myself and my family have signed up for it, and I pay the premiums to ensure that I have the good health care that JAG provides to cover my children and my wife and myself here in Ketchikan.
It is unclear when the National Labor Relations Board will decide whether to move forward with the union's charges. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Hunter Morrison.
And three of Alaska's key shipping companies are set to hike rates as fuel prices skyrocket amid the war with Iran. The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfall reports the change could affect communities across the state.
Alaska Marine Lines, Matson, and Tote are all increasing their fuel-related surcharges this spring. Alaska Marine Lines, or AML, ships freight to communities in Southeast, including Haines, Juneau, and Skagway. The company said late last month that its surcharge will increase from 11% to more than 18% starting in early April. In an emailed statement, the company said the move reflects continued escalation and volatility in fuel costs. Some small businesses that rely heavily on shipping are already bracing for the change. Mike Healy owns the Skagway Brewing Company, one of the community's most popular and only year-round restaurants.
It will have a big impact, no doubt about it. The shipping on all of our goods will increase, and not just those from AML. My suppliers of every type all over the place are notifying us that there will be increases.
Healy added that his business has seen a number of significant cost increases in the last 5 or 6 years, including from tariffs more recently and during the pandemic. For the individual diner, the increase likely won't be huge, maybe 10 cents for a hamburger. But Healy adds,
if we don't take into account that 10 cents for the thousands of hamburgers that will be sold this summer, then we're missing out and we're losing out.
The increases will affect other businesses, too. Glenda Gilbert owns Haynes Home Building Supply, a local hardware store.
Yes, it impacts us. Yes, the prices have gone up or will have to go up more, and that's based on oil prices.
Jim Lampkins of Lutech Lumber in Haynes, meanwhile, says he wasn't surprised about the increase. Those are typical when fuel prices fluctuate. But he wasn't overly concerned about what it would mean for the business's bottom line. Southeast isn't the only region that could see impacts. Matson, for instance, ships freight to Dutch Harbor and Unalaska, Kodiak, and Anchorage. The company is boosting its fuel-related surcharge from around 20% to about 26% for all Alaska customers. The change will take effect by mid-April. Matson said in a statement that the move is the result of a, quote, sudden and significant increase in marine fuel prices. The company said it expects the increase will sustain as long as global oil supply constraints persist in the Middle East. Tote, meanwhile, implemented a smaller increase from 25 to 27% in late March. Reporting in Haynes, I'm Avery Elfelt.
And in the U.S. Supreme Court showdown over the 14th Amendment last week, justices sharply questioned the Trump administration's lawyer for invoking Native American history to challenge the birthright citizenship of immigrants. KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports on why his argument faced resistance.
In defending President Trump's executive order against birthright citizenship, Solicitor John Sauer compared Indian tribes to foreign governments. He argued the U.S. Constitution treats tribes as sovereign nations, and that when the country was founded, tribal members and their children were not considered citizens, much like the children of foreign diplomats, a standard that he says should be applied to immigrants.
You're using some pretty obscure sources to get to this concept.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor challenged Sauer's reasoning.
The Indian tribes were analogized to foreign diplomats. So what do we do with that?
I'd say two things. First, as the Indian tribes, we think that's a case that strongly supports us.
But Bob Anderson, an Indian law professor at Harvard, says that comparison just doesn't hold.
And they were really stretching to make it apply, and I think they failed.
Anderson says those doubts raised about Sauer's case appear to cut across ideological lines.
It seemed to me that the conservative members of the court recognized that. I was surprised that they seemed to be so much in alignment with the opponents of the Trump administration.
Justice Neil Gorsuch, a widely regarded expert on Indian law, pressed Sauer on Native American citizenship.
You think they're birthright citizens?
No, I think the clear understanding that everybody agrees in the congressional debates is that the children of tribal Indians are not birthright citizens.
I understand that's what they said.
Justice Gorsuch eventually got Sauer to agree that by today's standards, tribal Indians are birthright citizens. But then Sauer walked that back.
Not sure. I have to think that through.
So based on the Trump solicitor's arguments, should Native Americans worry about their citizenship status? Anderson says,
no, there's no way that this case could affect the citizenship of Indian tribes because Congress passed a separate law in 1924, automatically making all tribal members in the United States citizens.
The 1924 law passed decades after the 14th Amendment to close the loophole that had left Native Americans without automatic citizenship. The law, though, did not affect their tribal government-to-government status under the Constitution. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
This is KTOO. Thanks for tuning in.